We'll call number three on calendar, People v. Michael Goodwin. The panel on this matter is comprised of Justices Grimes, Bigelow, and Rubin.
Good morning, Your Honor. I have to apologize to the court. I've been ill with a cold, and so my ears are stuffed up, and I'm not hearing very well, and I probably sound really awful. But
okay. We'll try to speak loudly with our questions then.
All right. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, if I may.
All right.
Okay. The theme of this prosecution was, if not Goodwin, then who else? The prosecutor's strategy was to present extensive evidence of Goodwin's bad character, motive, and threats against the Thompsons, and at the same time blocking all evidence showing investigators either deliberately or negligently pursued Mr. Goodwin from the outset, ignoring evidence potentially implicating other people. On closing, the prosecution exploited that excluded evidence to the prosecutor's advantage. But what I see in this case as the fatal flaw is that there's insufficient evidence to show association or a connection between Mr. Goodwin and the killers, who were never identified. The witnesses couldn't even determine what race these people were. It was back and forth. Even assuming that the Stevensons correctly identified Goodwin as being in the car in front of their home 10 days or a week before the killings, there's insufficient circumstantial evidence to connect Goodwin to the killers, so there's insufficient evidence to hold him liable on a vicarious liability theory. The rules regarding use of an uncharged conspiracy to prove vicarious liability are that the prosecutor must separately prove each element to establish a conspiracy, and the prosecutor must prove each element beyond a reasonable doubt. I don't think that
the case at one level is somewhat simple.
Pardon me?
The case at one level is somewhat simple, even though it's very complex. Why isn't this substantial evidence? The Stevensons see Mr. Goodwin apparently casing the joint. We know there's killings there, regardless of the race of the actual perpetrators. It doesn't matter. There are two killings there. And Mr. Goodwin has a strong motive and has boasted about killing them. So, I mean, that's, you know, it's not the strongest case, but it has a couple of nice points there.
Well, he didn't boast about killing them. He I think at a couple of drunken parties, he made comments about wishing he was dead and then, you know, made comments about what it cost. And that sounds very, very incriminating. But the problem is, I searched for hours and hours, you know, cases in California and all over the country, looking for a case where the perpetrators were not identified. And there was no relationship, you know, no direct evidence of any relationship between, you know, the accused and the perpetrators. And in this case, all you've got is this one rather tenuous fact, because he wasn't at the premises of the killing. He was some distance away. It might have been a couple of miles. And even the two eyewitnesses, Mrs. Stevenson, stated that the reason she called the police was because she thought he was looking at the local elementary school, possibly looking for children. So you're asked to draw inferences from this fact, you know, rather dubious fact, that, you know, he was planning an escape. Well, I think in the absence of some other evidence that there was a communication about planning an escape route or something that connects him to these people, that simply isn't enough. And I'd sort of like to approach the court's tentative opinion point by point, because it seems to me that the court has, in the tentative opinion, lumped together, you know, everything, you know, without addressing separately each element, including association with the perpetrators. So
it's a long tentative, and I'm not going to try to change your order, and I appreciate, you know, there's a lot there. But the first issue does seem to be the attorney-client privilege materials, and I certainly have a great concern that the district attorney and the police department were in possession of attorney-client materials. That is something one ought to consider very, very carefully, because it's a fundamental part of our justice system. Can you articulate to me what advantage you think that gave the district attorney in the case as it unfolded?
As what?
As it unfolded.
As it unfolded?
Yeah, in other words, what do you think, in other words, where did they gain an advantage by having these documents?
See, the problem with having to show the advantage that they gained is that then you have to speculate on what the prosecutor did and, you know, how they were influenced by the materials. But, and I know the respondent poo-poos this notion, but they did have the attorney-client privilege communications about the bankruptcy and, you know, his finances and all of that.
But they were going to get that anyway.
Well, they wouldn't have the letters between counsel and Mr. Goodwin.
Right, but again, how, and I'm not minimizing what my great concern about this, but I'm trying to draw the nexus. What might have been, and I know you don't know for sure, but give me your best estimate of what might have been the advantage the district attorney had by having those letters.
Well, they discussed strategy in the letters, you know, Mr. Goodwin and his counsel. But, you know, I think it's a mistake to say, well, you have to show how you know, the prosecutor was influenced or how he could have used it. Because if you look at the cases about invasion of attorney-client privilege, I think this is the biggest invasion I've ever seen in a case. And I think it should shock the conscience. And I think the trial judge was shocked by it, too, but she kept backing away from, you know, removing those two prosecutors from the case. Or putting the attorney general on the case. And it's just, it's so messy and so hard to sort that stuff out. But it's just the fact that they had those materials and they didn't say anything. They knew they were privileged. And they never said, they didn't go to the court. And the ethical rules in California would require them to say, I found attorney-client privileged material, turn it over to the court. Not sit there and go over them. You know, so it just seems like it's such a fundamental wrong. But even if you can't point to a particular thing that they used against Mr. Goodwin, it requires reversal. These people should have been recused. It certainly arouses contempt for the judicial system and fear in people. You know, how can you openly communicate with your attorney if when the prosecutor manages to get his hands on your communications, the court just goes, well, what was the problem? No harm, no foul.
Seriously, the court did so many hearings on this and was so particular. I can't think your categorization of saying the trial court just said, well, it's nothing.
Trial court saying, well, it was nothing. I mean, she was concerned and she was
very meticulous.
Yeah, and she was very, very concerned about it. But, you know, in some cases, they're just so over the top that, you know, I wish she'd had the courage to say, you're removed from the case and put another prosecutor on it. But that's not what happened. But, you know, I think it's unfair to demand that the person whose fundamental rights were violated in such a way to try to speculate what was in the prosecutor's minds or how they might have used it. And especially in a case like this where the evidence against Mr. Goodwin was so weak. So, you know, it's like when you talk about depriving somebody of a defense, you know, you can't nitpick about, well, this would have been this and this would have been that. If it's such a wholesale deprivation, then it's really not fair and it really impugns the justice system to allow that to stand. But I'd like to get back to the court's tentative opinion on the lack of evidence of an agreement, if that's okay. So the court stated, the second claim that there was no evidence of an agreement or association with the killers is mistaken, too. There was no direct evidence, but a conspiracy may be proved by indirect evidence and inferences justified by the circumstances. So I think the court was citing as evidence of association five factors. And the first one was, the Thompsons were killed in a carefully planned operation for which there was no robbery or other motive. Well, neither of these facts is evidence of association between Goodwin and the killers. Carefully planned does not connect Goodwin to the killers. That's a generic fact. And that could apply to anybody. And then there was evidence of a robbery, but the defense evidence on this point was sanitized. And I don't really see a basis for sanitizing it to say, you know, so she couldn't, the defense attorney couldn't say that it was gold, right? So it was because of that, then the jurors had to speculate as to what it was that these, you know, potential robbers were after. And it just destroyed the defense about, you know, you can carry a bag, you know, gold in a bag. It would be a small item, but it's worth a lot of money. It's a fungible item. I mean, the court mentioned that they didn't take any jewelry, valuable jewelry, or things like that. Well, fencing something like that would probably be very difficult because it's, you know, it's highly personal, it's unique. but Gold is not. So, you know, how could the jurors understand? I mean, the prosecutor was arguing and exploited that point in particular on closing, that, you know, what could guys on bicycles take? You know, if they were going to rob the house, they would back up a truck and take larger items. So it didn't make any sense once you took out the reference to Gold. So that was one thing. And then the second point the court mentioned was, quote, defendant was in the neighborhood with binoculars a few days before the murders, close quote. Well, the response to that is, even assuming that Stevenson saw Goodwin in that car with binoculars, the circumstantial evidence is far too weak to support the inference that A, Goodwin was connected to the unidentified killers, or B, agreed with the killers to commit murder. I couldn't find a single case anywhere in the United States or in California in particular that finds association based solely on a person having been in the vicinity where the murders later occurred, just, you know, days before the killing. That, and to me, that's just too tenuous. And being, when you ask a jury to draw inferences from that, it's very speculative. I mean, if you had that evidence connected with somebody testifying to a conversation about escape routes, you know, with the killers or somebody associated with the killers, then it looks like that would be substantial evidence of association. But you have nothing like that in this case. And then the prosecutor also asked the jury to speculate about other things, like, and this is like the tenor of the whole case. He said, well, you know, the killers held up Trudy's head so that Mickey would see her being killed, and that, you know, they screwed a gun into Mr. Thompson's ear. But the coroner and the ballistics evidence totally contradicted that. So, you know, there was all this speculation, all this drama.
Well, there certainly was some hyperbole, as there is in many cases, but right. We have to sort of look at how significant that was. Let's go back to something you just mentioned. There was some evidence and a substantial amount of discussion about the fact that Mr. Thompson was sort of forced to watch his wife being killed, thus suggesting this was a very personal killing and not for robbery. Any thoughts about whether there's substantial evidence on that point and whether that point is significant in our analysis?
I don't think it's significant enough to establish association. And especially, you know, the fact that that Mr. Goodwin was deprived of his ability to show that other people had motive against Mr. Thompson, like the Vagos motorcycle gang. You know, and there was evidence that if the investigators had pursued it, that there might have, you know, it was personal there too. I mean, if you go and testify against a gangster, even if the testimony, you know, if it's only as to alibi or if you consider it weak, gangsters are not usually the most rational people in the world, and they don't like it. You know, like you talk about the Hispanic gangs issuing green lights against people from prison and all that. Well, you know, people are nuts, basically. Gangsters are a little nuts. So you can't discount that, you know, and the jury never heard any of that. And to me, that's much stronger evidence than, you know, Mr. Goodwin being so angry. Mr. Goodwin's an angry man, and he's not a pleasant man. He's kind of a jerk. But being a jerk isn't a crime. You know, you still have to connect Mr. Goodwin to these people, these unknown people who did the killing. And I really don't think circumstantial evidence in the form of Mr. Goodwin allegedly being in a car with binoculars 10 days to a week before the killings is sufficient to do that. And I couldn't find a single case showing facts like that where, you know, the evidence was found to be sufficient. I mean, if you look at all these hitman cases, there's always something. There's like an ex-girlfriend or a friend who testifies that the guy was asking around about, you know, who can I hire, you know, and that there's a paper trail, like somebody says something about money and how I'm going to get it to you. There's a, you know, there's a body found in the trunk of a car parked in the driveway, you know, of a friend, you know, with a note saying, get rid of this. There's something, you know, there's some relationship that connects the person to the co-conspirator. And even if he doesn't have to know all of the co-conspirators, there has to be some interaction, some evidence connecting him to one or two.
But I think you're just talking about the difference between having direct evidence of an agreement as opposed to indirect or circumstantial evidence of the agreement. And the circumstantial evidence seems to be pretty strong, indicating that there was an agreement. I mean, the murderers knew where the Thompson house was, how to get away. They knew the timing of when things were going to be so that they could find him in the driveway at the time that they went there. And certainly Mr. Goodwin had his arch rival was Mr. Thompson.
And how is that information unique to Mr. Goodwin? Why couldn't they have gotten it some other way? Like perhaps they were surveilling or had somebody else surveilling.
But that's not the question when we look to, on review, a claim of insufficiency of the evidence.
But I'm saying that that's generic.
We review all the facts in the matter most favorable to the verdict.
Right.
So I don't want to go outside the appellate review standard in doing that.
No, I understand that. But even using that standard, knowledge of that fact is not exclusive. Those facts that you just listed are not exclusive to Goodwin, even if he knew these things.
I guess what it seems to me is that not only are you not finding the value in the circumstantial evidence, but you can take a piece of circumstantial evidence and separate them, and each one of them may not be sufficient. But when you have them all together,
but how is that evidence of association between Mr. Goodwin and these unknown killers?
Well, funny for you, I get to ask the questions, not you asking me.
I just don't see it. I mean, I don't. You know, he's not the only person in the world who knew where Mr. Thompson and his wife lived. And, you know, if that comes back to that theme of if not Goodwin, then who? You know, that inference that the prosecutor asked the jury to draw. And that's just not sufficient. I mean, Goodwin is not the only person who knew that. So how can you say, well, you know, he knew him and he was mad at him and all that, so he must have. Who else would have done it? Well, anybody can get somebody's address. Anybody can watch a house and see when people are coming and going. And I just really don't think that's... you know, strong evidence, because you can't separate Goodwin out from anybody else in that instance. It's something anybody could have.
Okay, you know what? I think we get your point on that, and you briefed it really well, too. Do you want to move on? I think that there was some question about the pre-arrest delay, and in conference we had some discussion about that, so if you want to turn to that, it might be helpful.
Okay. You won't allow me to address it. The last 2 points that the court relied on, it's tentative about association?
If you want to, I'm just telling you what's going to be helpful to us, but please go ahead.
Very briefly,
Goodwin, the
court said Goodwin repeatedly threatened to kill Mickey Thompson and hurt the family for ruining the defendant financially. Well, that's evidence of motive. It's not evidence of association. And there are lots of other people with motive, so I really don't think that factors into finding association. And there are no cases that I've seen that do that. And Goodwin making statements to two witnesses about the cost of having Mr. Thompson killed and telling others that he was too smart to get caught. Well, had there been evidence that witnesses had overheard Mr. Goodwin making those statements to the killers or somebody associated with the killers, that would be evidence of association. But, you know, somebody getting drunk at a party and being macho and you know, being over the top and comments like that, that's not evidence of association.
You're saying that every time that Mr. Goodwin made a threat about Mr. Thompson, the evidence showed he was drunk?
No, not every time.
Okay.
I'm just saying he's a very hostile, over-the-top sort of person, but you can have all the motive in the world and you can yell and threaten, but if you don't have any association with the people who did the killing, that's not proof beyond a reasonable doubt. It's very speculative. So, you know, what those witnesses repeated was loose talk by a man who's known for his loudness and over-the-top statements, and that's not evidence connecting him to the killers. And you have to remember, keep those each element of conspiracy separate. You have to prove each one separately beyond a reasonable doubt. And then the court concludes these facts allowed the jury to infer that the defendant agreed with its shooters to commit the murders. Well, only one of those five facts listed by the court, which is the sighting of Goodwin in front of the house, in the Thompson's neighborhood, could even arguably be relied upon to show a connection to the unknown shooters. And the prosecutor asked the jury to draw from the Stevenson's testimony the inference that Goodwin was in the Thompson's neighborhood planning the escape route. But that's pure speculation, and you can't base proof, you know, beyond a reasonable doubt on speculation. And that's what it is. You know, it's the same thing as, you know, saying, oh, the killers held up Trudy's head so that he would see Mickey Thompson would see her being shot. So from what authority I could find, all courts to date indicate that without some direct evidence of association with at least some of the perpetrators, circumstantial evidence cannot amount to proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And I challenge the respondent or the court to find cases that, you know, permit on such slender evidence a finding of, you know, association. Let's see. I asked, where are the cases upholding convictions where the killers are not identified? There is no evidence whatsoever of any communications with the killers. There's no evidence of any relationship to or meetings with them. I don't think those cases exist. So I don't know if this court wants to be the first court to uphold a murder conviction based on speculative evidence, because that's what we've got here. It's just speculative. It's not proof beyond a reasonable doubt of association.
Well, I guarantee you we will not uphold a murder conviction on speculative evidence, but that's really not the test for us.
Yes, well. Now, in terms of the Dillion prosecution, the respondent offered a new case, the Jones case, which I assume the court has reviewed, People v. Jones, 2013, 57 Cal 4th, 899. Well, Jones confirms the process the trial court must employ in addressing a delay in prosecution claim. First, the defendant must demonstrate prejudice, which was found in this case. Second, the prosecutor must offer a justification for the delay. And third, the court has to balance the harm to the defendant against the justification for the delay. Well, in this case, the court did not address the third prong at all. She just said there's, you know, it was prejudicial, but there was a justification for the delay. So the trial court cannot be found to have exercised discretion because the court didn't perform that third step. And so I think the case has to be reversed on that basis. So my conclusion is, after 16 years, no direct connection was made between the killers and Goodwin. You've got weak circumstantial evidence. The prosecutor kept nearly all defense evidence out and then exploited the lack of defense evidence on closing. That's not a fair trial. And that's not a trial and a conviction that's based on substantial, credible evidence. And I think the case has to be reversed. I really do. And you have to try to overcome the distaste for Mr. Goodwin, who is thoroughly distasteful, and look at the facts and see what you've got in terms of evidence of association. So I'll respond. Or if you need a letter brief on any point, I'm
okay.
Certainly
letting Thank you very much. We'll save the rest of your time for rebuttal.
Deputy Attorney General Louis Carlin for respondent. May it please the court. If I may, just so I don't forget, I just want to respond to one thing my colleague said right off the top. There was no evidence that at the time any of respondent's threats were made that he was drunk or at a party. We laid out the threats very clearly, and there's not any evidence of drunkenness. I don't think any of the threats were made at a party. The threats were very specific. They were only specific to respondent. So was there a personal connection? Yes. This was not generic. These are personal threats directed at one person because of what happened, and that was the failed business relationship ending in the litigation. So the motive is shown very strongly by the threats, the nature of the threats, and they pinpoint both victims because there were clear threats that were made not only to harm Mr. Thompson, but also to harm his wife. And we have the strong evidence of Mr. Weisler, who actually overhears on a speakerphone within the month before the killing, that he hears defendants say, "I'm going to kill you and your wife." So these are very specific threats. They narrow the universe to one person. Only one person has that motive. And that motive was expressed very strongly to third parties who shared the same reason for that anger. And I think a key witness is Mr. Coyne, the bankruptcy trustee, had been trustee in, he said, 1,000 cases. He had never seen this extraordinary level of vituperation, of acrimony. That is very strong evidence. That is strong evidence that connects only one person to this killing.
There was a testimony where there was the offer concerning Joey Hunter, and that he had admitted killing the Thompsons and was paid for the killing and was seen a few miles from the scene riding a bike. That was all excluded, correct?
Correct. I don't know about the bicycle detail. I think he was trying to hitchhike, they said, about an hour afterwards.
Right, but I believe the testimony was that he had a bicycle with him.
Oh, but I
could be wrong, too.
Yeah,
but either way, he's near the scene. He admits the killing. His motive is to take blame for it and get $50,000. Why is that not admissible under the current standards of our Supreme Court on third-party culpability?
It was found to lack, again, the standard is, can a reasonable juror for third-party culpability find that person guilty? And this evidence was shown to be entirely speculative.
What is speculative about it?
Well, there was no testimony available that he could not testify to that fact, and they had no one else who could offer that testimony.
Well, then you're saying it's not so much that it was improper third-party culpability evidence. You're just saying there was no evidence of this, that the defense was unable to provide evidence of what I just said under our rules of evidence.
Certainly the second point is true. The first point, there was never shown any connection between this suspect and the murder itself, other than his presence there. And it was shown that, for instance, the supposed identifications of him were based on a inaccurately drawn witness drawing. So the evidence trying to connect him to the scene was also very sketchy. There simply wasn't enough. I'm sorry.
But you know, there's a certain irony here that in a case where the prosecution's case is somewhat sketchy, in the sense that for all the reasons that counsel had mentioned, and that the key event is, in my mind, is putting Mr. Goodwin at the scene a few weeks before the killings, that now all of a sudden, where someone else is alleged to have been at the scene on the day of the killings, as apparently willing or apparently has admitted the killings, that you would say that that's so tenuous that we don't let the jury even hear that.
Well, when it's stated abstractly, one could say yes, if you had another confession, but it would have to be a reliable confession, and it would have to be a confession that can be admitted under the rules of evidence.
I forget. Was Hunter not going to testify? It was that he told someone else? Was it a declaration against interest type of testimony?
There was supposedly that he confessed to another, to someone while in custody. But that, again, it was found to be so unreliable. And
okay.
It simply didn't rise to the level of being admissible.
So are you saying the seminal case on this point would be Hall, right, from the California Supreme Court?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And that there has to be some connection between the person who's alleged to be the accurate perpetrator or the other perpetrator, the third-party culpability, and the commission of the actual crime.
Yes,
you're saying is lacking.
That's correct, Your Honor. and again, presence an hour after the killing really gets you nowhere. The whole point of the killing was obviously to make a quick, undetected escape. The perpetrators rode bicycles down a windy lane that they would have to have planned out before, that they could get to freeway access within minutes. A person trying to hitchhike an hour later, it just doesn't make sense. So even on the face of it, it doesn't make sense.
Let me turn to the attorney-client privilege materials. First of all, would you say that there was impropriety in the obtaining of the attorney-client privilege materials?
If there were any impropriety, Your Honor, it would have been in the prior prosecution. Okay. And it's really important to look carefully at the record here and remember that there were exhaustive hearings on this. And the trial court looked at everything and found that the exposure to the Los Angeles prosecutor was accidental. That's a quotation from the record. That's a finding from the record. Volume 4 of the reporter's transcript at V for Victory 20. And that is supported. The only deputy who saw these documents was Deputy Jackson. He said at the June 2nd, 2005 hearing, and this is page 35 of that transcript, which is separate, he didn't know about it. He did not know there were privileged materials in that box until trial counsel made the motion and showed him.
So then would you attribute the outrageous governmental conduct, if there were some, to the Orange County DA's, not to the Los Angeles County DA's office?
If there were improprieties, it was definitely the Orange County prosecution. The accidental exposure to privileged materials is not misconduct. And it is central for any type of misconduct that you be able to show prejudice or a reasonable likelihood of prejudice. Now, certainly for the recusal standard, we've now had the entire trial. The standard under Vasquez is to show where that prejudice was. Outrageous government actions? Well, you cannot use a vicarious standard, the Kyle Z. Whitley standard, to show misconduct. It doesn't make any sense. Yes, it is a Brady doctrine. We want to make sure that defendants receive all the materials they are entitled to. Misconduct means misconduct, and it has to be personal. It has to be that the prosecutor exploited or personally used improper evidence. Here, we have a rule in place. We have an incredibly careful trial judge saying, let's get a special master, identify every document. We will make sure you don't use it. We'll have a hearing. We had at least three. Deputy Jackson states as an officer of the court, and the court finds him credible, every privileged piece of information in those documents was available from a non-privileged source. And we can test that out with the e-brief project. We can do a search. I did one. Plug in JGA Whitehead or whatever the whatever that entity was, and you can search for it. And you can find it in the letters, and you can say, "Well, this was in an attorney-client letter, but how does it help? Why wouldn't the prosecutor already know that from a non-privileged source? They have the trustee, they have Dolores Cordell, who was the Clark and Trevithick lawyer." Representing them during the bankruptcy, all the post-conviction proceedings, post-trial proceedings, they would have known that. And of course, all the charging decisions were made before the prosecuting deputies even knew about the privileged materials.
So, just to categorize, one last thing. So then you would say if there was impropriety, it would be the Orange County DA's office having conducted the search and going into a room that had a sign on it that said this contains attorney-client privileged documents, right?
Correct. And just to follow up on that, what Deputy Jackson said is that these were boxes of documents that were just shipped over to the Los Angeles shop.
So they came to Deputy Jackson with no indication that they came from that source indicating attorney-client privilege. Correct?
Right. There's no sign on it. There's no saying privileged materials.
Okay.
And again, he said, I didn't know they were there until I was alerted to it by defense counsel.
Okay.
But you would agree that the distinction between the Orange County DA and the Los Angeles County DA is germane only on the question of use of the materials and exploitation. Because certainly if the Orange County officers acted improperly and the L.A. DA used the materials, that would be wrong, correct? Too complicated? Too many commas in that question?
No, I just want to be careful with my answer, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yes, if you could show an actual nexus, Orange County says, hey, we've got some privileged materials. You might find them useful. Yeah, I think, sure. But the whole notion of prosecutorial misconduct is a knowing exploitation of this. So, yes.
And there's no evidence of knowing exploitation here. And, in fact, when I asked Ms. Harper the same question, she really didn't try to articulate prejudice. She argued really almost an outright reversal just for the government misconduct.
Right. And so that would be the test if it were outrageous government misconduct. And as pointed out in the brief, no court has found that yet. And this is not the stomach pumping of forced stomach pumping of a defendant to get evidence.
True, but it invades something that we all hold dear, both constitutionally and all of us who participate in the criminal justice system, and that's the attorney-client privilege.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And I think it's really important in this issue that we have a trial judge like we did here who is not going to take it on faith, who's not going to say, prosecutor, whatever you say, I agree with. No, I'll hire a special master. I'll look at the documents myself. I will get to the bottom of this. And
there's no doubt that the trial judge's conduct on this issue was exemplary. I mean, it was really, as I read this, it just went on, and it was a great diligence on her part. Let me go back to another question. I'm not asking about outrageous government conduct. I'm not using that term. But I'd like you to answer my very first question in this area, and that is, do you think what happened in Orange County with the taking of the attorney-client privilege materials was inappropriate?
Well, you know, we don't know very much about it. What we do know is that the seizure of documents was correct according to the search warrant. We have a clear finding here, and there's nothing in the record and no attempt to dispute that. So what happens when you get documents that have plain attorney-client privilege documents on them? Well, courts have now articulated what you should do, and we don't know whether Orange County did it. It looks like they may not have. But sure, what they should have done is you take one deputy, paralegal, I don't know. You take one person and you use a screening procedure. Because, of course, the fact that a privileged document exists doesn't mean you can never look at it. If the privileged document is trying to has evidence or is an instrumentality of a crime, the privilege doesn't protect that. So you can look at the document if it's within the search warrant, and these were. But yes, you would have a screening procedure so that if you were to prosecute afterwards, you would make sure, and you could track this, that no privileged documents were ever shown to the prosecutors. Correct.
All right, so fair to say it appears there was some impropriety, but the record's not totally clear?
The record
is certainly... Let me see how far I can push, Mr. Carlin.
Certainly, the trial judge had strong suspicions that this wasn't done correctly. And I think from the fact that you get a bunch of boxes of documents and there is no notation that there's privileged documents inside, there's no segregation of them, yes, it does look like there probably was impropriety.
Thank you.
Your Honors, I do want to just a few points about statement was made about that the witnesses couldn't even agree on the race. In fact, at trial, the two witnesses who saw the killers at trial both testified that they were African American, Lance Johnson and Allison Taurasi. She was impeached with a prior statement she had made. And that's a question that was for the jury. So that's really very, that's a very weak challenge to the evidence presented below.
Is the race actually important in this? I mean, it would be if you were obviously prosecuting the perpetrator, but what does it really matter?
It really isn't it isn't of significant consequence. I think the argument was just made, well, you can't believe this witness. But that's prototypical question for the jury. The issue about the gold, well, the court went into that in great detail. And the court said, yes, we will allow you to present this. Show us evidence that the possession of gold was communicated to a third party in such a way that other people with a motive would be there. No evidence. In fact, Eric Miller didn't even remember saying it. What he said was, I don't remember it. If you have evidence that I told an investigating officer, I was telling the truth, but I don't remember it. That's the sum and substance of it. Now, the idea when the proffer was made to the trial court was, we will be able to show you that there was tampering with the safe. Well, they couldn't. It turned out there was no credible evidence of that. The only evidence of tampering was after, when there was apparently they wanted to go through the safe weeks or months after. So when you have that, when you have strong evidence that there was no attempt to break into the house is armed, and the alarm didn't go off. There was no evidence of a forced entry. Well, my colleague says, if they were after gold, they would have left all this jewelry. That would be traceable. They left cash. That's the most fungible thing there is. There was over $1,000 of cash in the running minivan. There were hundreds of dollars in Mr. Thompson's wallet. So there is no evidence that the killers were trying to do anything other than assassinate these two people. That's the only evidence.
There was evidence at Primark's sometime later, as you said. You said weeks or months. I don't remember the record well enough, so we're in the same boat. But is there not a reasonable inference that those Primark's were from an earlier period? And obviously, or did someone testify at the scene? I just don't remember.
There was evidence because they asked the investigating officers.
Okay. And he said he looked at the garage safe and there were no Primark's.
There are no Primark's. Okay. So you have positive evidence, no Primark's. You have testimony later that at the time, I think it was with regard to the estate matters, that there were the Primark's.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions,
I think
respondent
not.
Will submit.
Thank you, Mr. Carlin.
I'd like to address several points. First, Mr. Carlin said there's no evidence that Goodwin was drunk when he made threats. I didn't say that he was drunk every time he made a threat. I believe there was testimony by one of his friends at a dinner party. They were at a dinner party, and you know, they were talking about, you know, how much he hated Thompson, and they may have been talking about how much a hitman would cost, or, you know. But I didn't claim that he was drunk at every single instance. It doesn't matter how personal or how vociferous or how angry, you know, the threats were. Threats alone they're not evidence of association. Again, there were other people who were angry at Thompson. That evidence wasn't heard by the jury. But I mean, I've said I wished certain people dead, and I've said it in the presence of other people. So if that person, you know, shows up dead and nobody knows really who did it, is the inference there that I had him killed? I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. I mean, this isn't how the world works. And it just isn't evidence of association. Let's see. I'm not sure that Mr. Carlin's representations about Mr. Weisler's overhearing of telephone conversation is accurate. I'd have to look at the record again, and if the court wants, a letter.
We'll let you know if we need a letter brief. We can check the record ourselves. Thank you.
Saying only one person had motive, that's flat out not true. There were other people. The evidence was in the prosecutor's own files. I mean, everything that the defense counsel brought up about other possible perpetrators, it's all in the prosecutor's files. So, you know, you can't say that only one person had motive. It's just that the jury never got to hear that. It doesn't matter how strong Mr. Coyne's testimony is about, you know, how angry Goodwin was. It still doesn't show association, and that has to be separately proved. Joey Hunter admitted that he was paid to kill the Thompsons. I mean, that is so much stronger than any case against Goodwin. And again, it's all in the prosecutor's file. You know, these are the investigators', you know, materials in the prosecutor's file. So how can you say it's unreliable? And why can't the defense impeach an investigation? They didn't follow these leads. They didn't follow the polygraph results. Joey Hunter's the one who flunked the 3 polygraph tests. He confessed. And yet they didn't follow through on that. And they go after Goodwin because Goodwin's a jerk. And, you know, people didn't like him. And they focused on him early on, and they ignored everybody else. And the jury never heard that.
Did the defense offer a witness who would testify that Mr. Hunter confessed to him?
I'm not sure that he would have to do that. You know, the cops all testify. You know, get Lilienfeld up there and ask him. It was his investigation. And Griggs, he was there, but he wasn't. You couldn't cross-examine him on it because the court wouldn't allow that evidence in. And I don't think it is third-party culpability. You can look at it two ways. And I think third-party culpability is not the analysis. The analysis is the prosecutor had all this information in the files. They didn't follow up. And it's so much stronger than anything they had against Goodwin. It's just that Goodwin's hateful, and he's loud, and he's a pretty obvious target for a prosecution, especially when other people are pressing for it.
So you're saying the prosecution should have done the handiwork for the defense, I guess.
No, I'm saying that the defense should have been able to question the investigators in front of the jury to show what they did and didn't do. That's what I'm saying. Because, you know, I don't think there's any question that it's a legitimate defense tactic to you know, question the integrity of the investigation. I mean, it's done all the time. So why wasn't he allowed to do it in this case? And there's so much material. I mean, it's just shocking to me that you could consider upholding this conviction given the evidence that the jury didn't hear and then the way the prosecutor exploited it. They went on and on about, oh, no, robbery, blah, 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 blah. You know, no evidence of anybody else. It's, if not Goodwin, then who? They kept saying that.
Just so I understand the point I think you just made, you think the analysis of Hunter in terms of third-party culpability is incorrect.
And I think it's unnecessary.
All right, so we can ignore that. We should instead focus on the Hunter testimony as it shows the defect of Griggs and Lilienfeld.
Exactly. Okay. I really do. I mean, I just don't think that they you know, it happens all the time, and convictions get reversed. You know, habeas petitions get granted because it turns out they focused on the wrong person. And in this case, it's so strong because it's not like the defense, you know, has to come in and show that they did this or there was this person or that person. It's all in the prosecutor's file. So how can you ignore that? And how could you not allow the defense to cross-examine the prosecution witnesses on that? It just doesn't make any sense at all. Okay. So anyway, the case against Joey Hunter is so much stronger than the case against Goodwin. So it should shock the conscience that it wasn't brought up to the jury. Carla was talking about the identifications of Hunter, but you know, there were several people who contacted after they saw the sketch. I think it was in the newspaper of Joey Hunter. They called the police and said, "Yeah, I know that guy. I already seen him." And the record does show that he was trying to hitchhike with a bicycle, which made him really stand out when people saw him. And so what if it was an hour after the killings? Maybe, you know, these guys are not rocket scientists. Who knows what the plan was, if there was a plan, you know, for these crazy people with the bicycles. I mean, it's also speculative because nobody ever really looked at it. And it's not the defense's fault that the prosecutors didn't investigate it. But let's see. I think there was something like 10 people identified. I can't remember the exact number, but I know that several people did contact the police. I like your sense of irony, because that's really the problem. You have such strong evidence against other people and such weak evidence against Goodwin. And again, you can threaten until you're blue in the face, and you can have all the motive in the world, but if there's no connection between him and those people who killed the Thompsons, that's the end of this case. You know, it's not a strong case, and especially in light of the inability of the defense to attack the investigation. That's just fatal. It has to be fatal. Let's see. Okay, regarding attorney-client privilege invasion, I don't think you can separate out the impropriety between the Orange County prosecution and the Los Angeles prosecution. Number one, it's the same investigator. It's Lilienfeld, you know, and he knew what materials there were, and he should have had some kind of ethical sense about, you know, the prosecutors in L.A. seeing that stuff. You just can't separate it out. It doesn't matter whether the violation was accidental or intentional. The minute they saw that there were letters between Mr. Goodwin and his attorneys, they should not have looked at those letters. They should have taken them to the court and said, we found these materials. They appear to be attorney-client privilege, and the court should have taken care of it. They knew well before trial that they had attorney-client privileged materials, and they just kept them. How do you justify that? And it was a massive amount of material. It's just overwhelming, and it really does impugn the justice system that they got away with that. Let's see. The issue about whether, you know, the prosecution team concept should apply, you know, like the one that's articulated in Brady cases, should apply here. I don't think it matters that it has to do with misconduct. That doesn't make sense to me. The prosecution team had information. They knew they shouldn't have had it, and they didn't turn it over. And Lilienfeld was part of that prosecution team, and he was involved in the Orange County prosecution. How is that not a prosecution team? You know, how does that not make the L.A. prosecutor responsible? I can't separate that out in my head and say that can be justified. So I really do think that it would be, I think it's a case of first impression, but I think that the Brady prosecution team concept should be applied in this case. And I'm not sure that every piece of evidence was available elsewhere. That was never really made clear on the record. The prosecutor kept arguing that, there was a screenplay and things like that, but I think the court rejected that and said no. I don't think that determination was ever clearly made. Again, I think prejudice has to be irrelevant in a case that's this massive. You know, it's just such an insult to the whole system and the sanctity of the attorney-client privilege. Mr. Carlin, and also I think your tentative opinion states that the search was upheld. It wasn't. I had to settle the record to determine what happened to that 1538.5 motion, and the upshot was that the defense dropped it. They just saw all this thing as this gestalt, you know, there's this, all these different violations going on, and they didn't ever make a determination about the validity of the search. About the Orange County District Attorney and their impropriety, Mr. Goodwin's attorney at the time in Orange County wrote a letter to the DA in Orange County and protesting the fact that they had attorney-client privileged materials and asked the DA to return them, and the DA refused. And after that, the DA packed them up and sent them to the LA County prosecutor. So the record is clear on that. There was impropriety. Regarding the gold, I'm not sure Mr. Carlin had his facts correct. Eric Miller was impeached, I believe, with police reports where he had stated to the police that Mr. Thompson had made statements about making a purchase of gold. My memory's not clear in that. If I'm wrong, you know, you can check the record. Regarding tampering with the safe, they don't even know whether the gold was in the safe if Mr. Thompson had the gold. And the fact that they left $1,000 in cash is kind of petty, considering that if it's true that Mr. Thompson had $500,000 worth of gold, they're going after the $500,000 worth of gold, and they're in a rush, and they're not going to be, you know, looking in people's wallets, and it just doesn't make sense. You know, if it's as highly planned as it, you know, the prosecutor says, these guys, if they knew they were going to get $500,000 and take it in the little canvas bags that, you know, the witnesses saw, they're going to get in there, take the gold, and get out. They're not going to be looking for other minor things, and they're not going to look for things that are going to incriminate them. So I think I've rebutted whatever Mr. Carlin has stated on those points. So I thank you for your attention, and I hope you reverse.
Thank you very much, Ms. Harper. Mr. Carlin, very well argued and very well briefed. Thank you very much.